Court, Your Honors. Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Sandra Collins. In this case, the administrative law judge found that Ms. Collins' only limitations were to avoid any exposure to extreme cold or to vibration. He found that it is very clear that she only had minor involvement of the skin prior to her date last insured. But the evidence in this case establishes that prior to the expiration of her insured status, Ms. Collins suffered from Raynaud's phenomenon, which was varyingly described as significant Raynaud's in the hands and feet or remarkable Raynaud's phenomenon. She also already had developed what's called sclerodactyly, or a tightening of the skin caused by the condition of scleroderma. Several doctors noted swelling in her fingers, and a rheumatologist specialist that she was referred to noted atrophy of the soft tissues in the fingers. So how the ALJ determined that it was very clear that the evidence showed she only had minor involvement of the skin is not established in his decision. As I just referenced in the other case, according to Social Security ruling 96-8P, the RFC assessment must include a discussion of why reported symptom-related functional limitations can or cannot be reasonably accepted as consistent with the medical or other evidence. Ms. Collins testified that when her fingers were purple, when she was in the cyanotic phase of the Raynaud's phenomenon, that her fingers would be numb, that at other times she had extreme pain in her fingers. During those times, she could not button her clothes. She could not even pick up a pen or a pencil. She couldn't feel a keyboard or the keys on a calculator. The ALJ did not discuss that testimony or those reported limitations by Ms. Collins. Ms. Collins testified that her symptoms occurred in 75-degree weather or cooler and in air conditioning. She also told her doctors this, and her doctors provided the opinion that she would experience these symptoms in 75 or cooler degree weather. Yet the ALJ only finds that she had to avoid extreme cold, and there's nothing in this record that indicates that Ms. Collins' symptoms only occurred in the dead of winter or only occurred when she was outside and in the dead of winter. There's a notation that she was wearing gloves in one of her doctor's offices when she was in for a visit, inside wearing her gloves. She wore gloves during her hearing and put hot packs in her mittens, and in fact testified that she would wear mittens and have to put hot packs in them in order to perform activities, even in the house, indicating it was very difficult to engage in some of her household activities while wearing the mittens.
She does have horses, does she not?
Yes, she does. And that was obviously the love of her life, and she did try to continue to engage in some of those activities.
Was she riding during this period of time?
I believe that she was still riding the horse. Yes, although the testimony was, I believe, that she would ride a couple of times a week. And in the winter months, her activities were greatly curtailed. There was a form that the ALJ relied on and the commissioner relies on, I believe it's Exhibit 4E, where the plaintiff actually spent a great deal of time detailing all of her activities. And she divided those activities between the summer months and the winter months. And a review of the activities in the winter months established that she would get up and she would go outside into the barn and she would clean the stall, filling a wheelbarrow, maybe halfway, I believe she said. But then she would go in the house, she would shower to rewarm herself, she would eat, she would relax, she would read a little bit, then she might eat lunch. She engaged in very little activity during the winter months. And the ALJ had to determine whether or not this claimant could engage in substantial gainful activity on a regular and continuing basis, not just whether she could engage in that activity during the summer months. The ALJ's credibility determination, in his formal findings, found what he called clear elements of exaggeration and secondary gain. But he doesn't explain in his decision what he meant by that, what he meant especially by secondary gain. But even he doesn't discuss what he meant by exaggeration. At no time in his decision, in the narrative portion of his decision, does he actually indicate what he's relying on to find the plaintiff not credible. He discusses varying evidence. He certainly discusses some things, as the commissioner points out, might be able to support a negative credibility finding. But as this court held in Golombuski versus Barnhart, an ALJ's credibility determination cannot be implied in his decision. It has to be explicit. He has to inform the claimant and any subsequent reviewers on what specific basis he found the plaintiff not credible. In this case, the ALJ did not do that. And finally, the ALJ did not properly analyze the opinions of the treating physicians. Although the opinions of the two treating physicians were given 6 years after the claimant's insured status expired, both of these doctors had been treating the claimant, or the plaintiff, excuse me, during the period of time before her insured status expired. And especially in a case such as this, with an unusual, a rare disease, where a person has physical findings on their body, such as the sclerodactyly, the cyanosis, cyanotic condition, atrophy of the soft tissues, the ability of a doctor to actually observe the plaintiff is very important in determining what the severity of their condition is. The Social Security non-examining physicians never observed her condition. They provided no explanation as to how they determined what the severity of the claimant's condition was. Also, the regulation at 20 CFR 404.1527, in conjunction with Social Security ruling 96-2P, specifically sets forth an analysis that the ALJ is required to perform. He was required to determine whether the treating source's opinions were well supported by medically acceptable clinical and laboratory diagnostic techniques, and whether they were not inconsistent with other substantial evidence in the case record. The ALJ made no finding as to whether or not the treating doctor's opinions were well supported. And looking at this record, again, given the findings of the experts and the lab work where she had multiple readings of positive ANA titers, positive SCL70 titer, which is specific for scleroderma, it appears that the clinical and laboratory findings do support the opinions of the treating physicians. In addition, the ruling says that the component of not inconsistent says that a well-supported treating source medical opinion need not be supported directly by all the evidence of record, so that it's not enough for an ALJ to find some evidence that's inconsistent in order for him to reject a treating physician opinion. And finally, both the regulation and ruling state that even if the treating physician's opinions are not entitled to controlling weight, they're still entitled to deference, that's what the ruling says, and often should be given great weight and adopted. And the regulation sets forth the detailed, maybe 7 different factors that the ALJ has to consider in weighing medical opinion. The ALJ in this case did not follow the requirements of the regulation, did not follow those factors or analyze those factors, and therefore his determination was erroneous.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schultz. Ms. Hammond?
May it please the Court, my name is Melinda Hammond for Commissioner Barnhart. The appellant's case rests on a faulty factual assumption. Her assumption is that the specific functional limitations described by Ms. Collins at her March 2002 hearing and by her doctors in their 2001 letters were present in whole in September 1995 when her insured status ended. The evidence specifically contradicts this theory. Ms. Collins testified about her current activities and limitations. She testified specifically several times that her symptoms have gotten worse and her activities have decreased over the years since she was first diagnosed with Raynaud's in the 1980s and with scleroderma in 1993. She also testified that she used to be capable of greater activities than those she described. The treating physician's letters, while concluding that Ms. Collins became unable to work in 1993, do not give any information about her specific limitations in the period from 1993 to 1995. On the contrary, they describe her then current symptoms and limitations, and they include limitations from her 2000 wrist injury, which cannot possibly relate to her condition in September 1995. Medical evidence was unanimous that her condition was progressive and deteriorating in terms of symptoms and functioning. despite the facts establishing that Ms. Collins' condition was not as severe in 1995 as when these descriptions were given, the appellant persists in arguing that ALJ must have accepted the later limitations as having existed from 93 to 95. The ALJ, however, evaluated this evidence properly. He acknowledged the physician's retrospective opinions of disability, but he accurately pointed out that the contemporaneous treatment notes contradict any inference that her symptoms and limitations had been so disabling from 93 to 95. He specifically explains why he does not credit Dr. Brower's opinion of disability at transcript pages 19 through 20 and provides further explanation at transcript page 21. He specifically explains why he does not credit Dr. Bugel's opinion of disability at transcript page 21. The ALJ discussed in detail the visits by Ms. Collins to her doctors and her therapist during the time from 1993 to September 1995, transcript pages 18 through 19. After discussing all the medical evidence and the opinions, the ALJ found that from 1993 to 95, her impairments caused only minor involvement of her skin. At the bottom of page 20 and the top of page 21, the ALJ explained why he reached this conclusion, and he cited specific medical evidence to support his explanation. This record contains many long, difficult medical terms and unusual impairments. The record also contains evidence that is easily understandable by laypersons. For example, at her hearing, when asked how her condition had progressed from 1993 to the current time, Ms. Collins offered a telling description. She testified that at the time Dr. Baim first diagnosed scleroderma, which was in March of 93, she had Raynaud's in the very tips of two fingers of one hand and one finger of another, and that at the current time in 2002, it had progressed up to her wrist. This description is perfectly consistent with ALJ's finding that during the relevant time, she had minor involvement of the diseases. The record contains medical opinions from the state agency physicians who were able to review all of the medical evidence for the relevant period that the degree of Raynaud's and scleroderma she experienced in 93 to 95 would not have imposed any exertional or manipulative limitations, but would have prevented exposure to extreme cold or vibration. In addition to the medical evidence, medical opinions from physicians who are expert in Social Security disability evaluation, the record contains a great deal of non-medical evidence about Ms. Collins' capabilities. The contemporaneous treatment notes show that in 1993, she and her husband kept two horses on their 16-acre farm. We know that in August 1993, she was able to pick up pails. That's at transcript page 245. We know that in April 1995, she shoveled snow. We know that in July 1995, she shoveled manure. Most telling, however, is the detailed description of her abilities and activities that Ms. Collins provided to support her application for disability in November 2000. It's at transcript page 125. In this list, Ms. Collins describes the activities that she was able to engage in even after her condition had 5 years to progress from the time her insured status expired. In 2000, 5 years after the insured status expired, before breakfast every summer morning, she would turn out the horses and groom them every other day. She would shovel manure out of the stalls that had accumulated over the night, amounting to one wheelbarrow full. She would take that out. She would clean the stalls during the week. Her husband would do it on the weekends. She would clean the water buckets and the outside tanks. Then she would rest for 10 minutes and eat breakfast. She did have longer rest periods during the day later, but she continued to engage in significant exertional activities that contradict the idea that 5 years earlier her progressive disease had been so bad that she could not have engaged in her past relevant work.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Hammond. Mr. Schultz, how much time did you have? 1 minute?
It's true that Ms. Collins testified that her symptoms progressed. By the time of the hearing, she had the sclerodactyly all the way up to her forearms, and the Raynaud's phenomenon affected her whole hand. That doesn't mean she wasn't disabled before her insured status expired. And although she may have testified much later that she thought she only hit in 93 she was experiencing the symptoms in several fingers only. At page 150 of the record, she actually told her treating physician in 1993 that she was experiencing the Raynaud's phenomenon in all of her fingers. She may have forgotten when that began, but the contemporaneous medical records show that she was experiencing it in all of the fingers before her insured status expired. That's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, counsel.